WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection. Remember the first great American aid program, the Marshall Plan? How well it worked and how it made us feel proud? Nowadays, the World Bank, the IMF, AID, the Asian Development Bank, it's an alphabet soup of agencies and acronyms that comprise a foreign aid army waging an international war on poverty. And yet we don't get that Marshall Plan feeling. The incomes of people in the developing world are not increasing. We have failed to move countries from poverty to some kind of prosperity, and some in the international community are calling for a wholesale change in the plan of attack. They hold that feel-good solutions like debt relief hurt, not help, developing countries, and they argue that the conventional if-we-build-it-they-will-grow approach has left the developing world littered with dams and schools and factories and other testaments to good intentions, as well as mistaken assumptions about what it makes to make an economy grow. Connection listeners, how much does the U.S. give in foreign aid? Where does it go? What does it do? And if the world's poor are only getting poorer and more numerous, what can we or should we do to help? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join us online at www.theconnection.org. My guests today in the studio are Bruce Scott, professor of business of administration at the Harvard Business School, and William Easterly, a senior advisor with the World Bank and author of the book The Elusive Quest for Growth, who is joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Thank you to both of you for being with us here today. Bill, I'd like to start with you. I remember from some of my reporting overseas and in this country from the late 90s, looking at some polls that showed that when Americans are asked how much, what percentage of the U.S. budget goes to foreign aid, the median figures, the median estimate that voters would come up with would be sometimes 15%, sometimes 20% of the U.S. budget is going to foreign aid. Give us a dose of reality on that.
Well, John, actually, it's 0.8%. It's really very little money compared to all the other things that the U.S. government spends money on.
What does it tell you, Bill, that the American public has this notion? And I would assume that an exaggeration of this comes along perhaps with a little bit of resentment or disagreement with the whole notion of foreign aid if people have inflated it in their minds to such a large figure.
Well, I think that the American taxpayer has the sense that foreign aid money is not being well used, and that dissatisfaction translates into a perception that there's a large amount of money involved, going of their money, their tax money, that's not being used very effectively. So that, I think that's where the misperception comes from.
Bruce Scott, just a brief primer on current U.S. aid. I don't want to bog you down in all of the numbers, but just give us a broad sense that that amount, less than 1% of the U.S. budget, is going to what countries in what forms?
The biggest recipients would be Israel and Egypt, and it's got a political context to it, and it's distributed all sorts of places.
A lot of that is military support?
Some of it is military, but this money is usable for different things, so it's going to a whole variety of places.
So you can Israel might receive military support, which frees up money for them to
I don't think that's what Bill's talking about. Right. That's going to be off on another. But you got economic aid. You've got economic aid going to the Egyptians. You've got economic aid distributed all over the place.
I know that both of you have raised some very serious issues, not necessarily with the concept of aid per se, but with the way that we do it. Bruce, what do you think is basically wrong? What basically needs to be fixed?
That the basic problems of economic development all over the world are fundamentally political and not economic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very hard for outsiders to deal with because to try to get to where the problems are, you're interfering with the affairs of sovereign states.
Can you be a little bit more concrete, paint a picture of a situation in which that might happen?
Sure. I'll give you two. The best metaphor for Americans to think about economic development is to take the differences between the North and the South here before the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
The North was pulling ahead of the South. The North had a different social system in a very important sense than the South had. The South had one where you had a relatively small elite that was abusing a substantial fraction of the population, and they knew they were falling behind. But keeping the social system was more important than keeping up with the North. Right? Now, if you had wanted to extend foreign aid from the North to the South at that point, it isn't going to do very much good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the matter of fact is, after the Civil War and after 12 years of occupation, if you had been extending aid from the North to the South, trying to help the blacks in the South, it still wouldn't have done very much good because it would have gone through a white government in every one of these states. Right? That's basically the metaphor you want to think about when you deal with this. Now, if you try to come from the outside and say, well, let's correct the political problems, you could come from the outside if it's Washington, D.C., but you can't come from the outside if it's the United Nations or Europe or anything else. Right? And when we finally did intervene, it's Dwight Eisenhower sending the paratroops to begin to change the system. And it's sending troops, federal marshals. That's where the reforms came from. And it came from political insistence that the system change. It didn't come from a foreign aid system.
And Bill Easterly, I suppose one of the great differences with the aid project we mentioned at the beginning of the program, the Marshall Plan, politically, the United States had great leeway at the end of the Second World War. The interesting thing about that plan is it leaves all of us with kind of a feeling of accomplishment and achievement. What was working there that just doesn't pertain today to most of the situations where aid is being focused?
Well, I think with the Marshall Plan, the U.S. government had a real genuine intention to promote the economic development of Europe. It didn't have so much the strategic interest of just propping up a given government that it has in some third world nations. And also you had the initial circumstances in Europe much more favorable for a high payoff to aid. You had a highly skilled population. You had a population with the knowledge of modern business techniques, modern technologies. And so injecting aid into those countries, and where everyone had strong incentives, they had a free market system that gave them strong incentives to invest in their own future prosperity. In third world countries, a lot of those conditions are absent. The aid donors often choose recipients for political reasons, like the donors propped up Mobutu in Zaire for many years just because he was a Cold War ally. The developing nations have governments, as Bruce said, that really are more concerned with preserving the privileges of those in power, whether they be the elite landowners or industrialists, or whether they be some powerful ethnic groups that exclude other ethnic groups. And that's the context in which third world governments have not pursued free market policies.
Short
they've interfered with free markets, and they've killed off incentives to develop.
Short of landing paratroops.
So I agree with Bruce, except I definitely disagree with sending in the troops.
Well, that's what I was
going to
ask you. Short of sending in the troops, how do you get around the power elite? How do you actually get to the ground and around the system that is exploiting the aid?
Well, actually, John, there are some successes that I think point to the way to go. There are successes like Korea and Taiwan for four decades now. There are some more recent successes like Uganda, Chile, India, and China. And in all of these cases, what happened was that there was a homegrown reform movement that the leadership itself decided to reform. And then the aid community only came in afterwards and supported the reforming governments, gave them advice. I think one thing the World Bank and IMF and other development agencies has done well is to give good advice as to what economic policies work. And so I think reorienting aid away from just sort of automatic disbursements to all poor countries. You know, we try to make them conditional, but it's very hard to impose the conditions, as Bruce said, because of the political constraints. So it's better, instead of rewarding promises of reform, to reward actual homegrown reforms that these countries pursue. And then I think we'll see more results.
Bruce Scott, a lot of the aid that was sent, for example, toward the former Soviet Union in the 1990s was predicated on the notion that the Russians overnight were going to create institutions that could make use of the aid. They were going to have a banking system. They were going to have land laws. They were going to have bankruptcy laws. They were, et cetera, et cetera. Overnight, a free market was going to grow up there. I was stationed there at the time, and as someone on the ground, it was clear to see that Russian politicians knew how to get the money by saying, yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that. And we know what happened. Is the whole notion of shock therapy, as they call it. Is it unfounded?
Yeah, basically it's nonsense unless you're dealing with a society that already has a capitalist economy, and therefore you can assume that you have the rule of law, you have an effective legal system, and you have a whole bunch of institutions. If you go back to your original example with the Marshall Plan, Bill points out that there was a genuine political understanding, but we didn't have to create a capitalist system for anybody in Western Europe. That's where capitalism was created to begin with. They had these institutions, and the fundamental thing that they had was a rule of law, okay, that says we're going to protect private property, we're going to protect people. That's very hard to get established elsewhere.
Well, does this turn into an argument for abandoning foreign aid in the places where there is not already a system like this in place?
John, can I break in on Russia? I just want to point out that in the early years in Russia, inflation was in the thousands of percent per year in the first 5 years of Russia's transition to a market economy. And, you know, aside from, I agree with Bruce about the need for good institutions, but you need first to get the basics right. And the aid community really didn't even get the basics right at the beginning in Russia.
Bruce, you were continuing with this question.
Well, I think another one of the basics is there is simply no way anybody is going to create an effective legal system, and the incentives and so on don't exist without an effective legal system.
So you can't do it quickly. So what do you do in these countries? Do you give up?
No, but somebody should have been starting with the notion, and what I would say is most of our economics community and economics teaching all over the country has ignored this stuff. It's only when the fiasco became apparent in the mid-1990s that you begin to have some serious attention going on in this within the economics faculties, the economics teaching, and I think of our own at where I teach. We weren't any better at that either.
So what do you do? Going forward, if you believe you still think there's a role for foreign aid in the world, although I see your eyes wandering, maybe you're thinking it over, maybe there isn't.
Well, I think it's a lot more limited than one would expect. If I go back here on what we've been talking about, the initial idea at the World Bank was that the essential resources in a developing country were largely there, and the role of the bank should be to make sure that they use them well and to try to assist the people that were using them well. When McNamara took over, that changed. And then you go to saying, hey, this is a welfare problem. We need to transfer resources. Have you transferred enough in resources? Mm-hmm. Which was very unfortunate. It meant that the bank was as much part of the problem as it was part of the solution.
Okay, but I'm still not hearing you really answer the question, what do you do?
Well, what you do is going to have to be where are you trying to do it and to what extent are people in control in the country really looking for help. All right? Now, we didn't play any significant role once the thing got going in Korea or Taiwan. We played a very significant role right at the beginning because they were helpless. Right? And our foreign aid could say, without land reform, without educational reform, without this and this and this, we won't do anything.
We're talking about foreign aid this hour. How much do we give, and do we need to give more, or do we just need to give it differently? That's the question to you, Connection listeners. The number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK is the number to call. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection. And Connection listeners, we're making the case for and against foreign aid, looking at the clash of politics and economics on roads that were paved with good intentions. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation, 1-800-423-TALK. My guests today are Bruce Scott, professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, and Bill Easterly, an economist and author of The Elusive Quest for Growth. We're also being joined now by Ray Offenheiser, who is president of Oxfam America, joining us from a studio in San Francisco. Good morning, Ray. Your organization really works quite closely with grassroots groups in developing countries, and you're probably known to the public primarily for emergency work that you do. through news reports in times of disaster and trouble. You're also doing longer-term work there of the kind we're discussing in this program, deeper relief. And the question to you is, as somebody who has this real first-hand experience, do you agree with the premise that it hasn't worked very well so far, that the model of aid has to change?
I would fundamentally agree with the premise that the model that has prevailed for much of the last 40, 50 years has not worked, and that we need to look at how we might overhaul foreign aid in some significant way. I'd like to maybe, in responding, I'd like to maybe just contextualize a little bit some of the comments that were made earlier. I think it's important for the listeners to understand that much of the foreign aid that was implemented over the last 50 years was implemented during the Cold War period. I think Bill made reference to this. And when the priorities were really assuring loyalty of client states is kind of the first principle, managing dissent of civil society participation, in other words, you know, making sure that there wasn't too much disruption from the grassroots in many of the countries where we were providing foreign aid. Mm-hmm. As opposed to sort of encouraging civil society or democratic participation, and overall assuring allegiance to the market model and openness to U.S. corporate interests. So there was a very strong concern that the U.S. interests were protected during the Cold War, and that we had a set of loyal client states. What was missing, I guess, from our point of view during that period was, and I think your other commentators have actually commented on this, but was a commitment to building strong democratic governance, strong institutions.
This was missing on the part of the governments, or are you saying
of,
that the
I think
that the
on
donor
part of the foreign aid? I think on the part of the foreign aid model itself. In other words,
how
the,
can a foreign aid donor build democracy in somebody else's country?
Well, I think we're seeing today how that can in fact happen. I mean, I think we're seeing much more concern today with a discussion about governance, about the role of civil society institutions, about the role of citizen participation in the development process, about how citizen participation might assure that governments are effect in delivering on their obligations to their citizens, and they're not simply serving the interest of a very narrow or small elite within their society, which is, I guess, the analogy that Bill was making to the U.S. South in the pre-Civil War period. So I think we're seeing some indications as to how a climate or a set of incentives, social as well as economic incentives, can be created or can be offered by the international community that make it more possible to build that kind of an environment in which this institution building for development can take place.
I'd like to give Bruce Scott a chance to respond to that.
Ray, can you give us a couple of examples of where you think this is working and how it works?
Well, I think what we're seeing in that has happened in Latin America over the last 20 years, I think would give some evidence to this. I mean, I think when I started out in the development field, we had a lot of authoritarian governments in Latin America that had been clients of the U.S. government, U.S. interests during the Cold War, and gradually we had returned to democracy, and we've had much more openness to participation of citizens in shaping the sort of direction of countries in Latin America. And while
income growth in many of these countries that you're talking about has not been at all stellar.
Right.
I think Chile, for example, is a case that stands out, where you have both an interesting model of strong economic growth, increasing economic participation, and you've got democratic governance at the same time, and a lot of citizen participation.
Yeah, but Ray, let's not confuse where you are today with how those reforms were implemented. They were implemented by a military dictatorship that assassinated a bunch of people. They were not put through by a democratic regime. The democratic regime has basically picked up and followed what Pinochet's regime put in place. Same thing happened in Taiwan. Same thing happened in Korea. Right? It takes a lot of power to make these reforms, and a military government has a better chance of doing it than somebody else.
Bill Easterly, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation.
Yeah,
on this.
I think... I certainly agree with Ray on the importance of citizen participation. I think what has often been missing from the foreign aid business is any mechanism for accountability to the ultimate beneficiaries. You know, are the customers satisfied? We should be out there doing systematic surveys of the intended beneficiaries to see whether they're satisfied.
Bill, who are the customers?
And then allocate aid accordingly.
Who are the customers in foreign aid?
The poor people in the poor nations.
Is there not also a sense that the donor countries want to get some bang for their buck as well?
I think that's changing over time. I think as all of us have said, the Cold War played a big part in where aid went, but the Cold War is over now, and so I think there's now a more genuine interest in just altruistically promoting economic development in the poor nations. And I think the best case for aid is that aid has allowed us to experiment with what works and what doesn't. It's sort of like you can think of cancer research as an analogy. Mm. Does the fact that we haven't found a definitive cure for cancer mean that we should stop spending money on cancer research? No. Mm-hmm. No. We've learned what are blind alleys and what are promising cures in cancer.
All right.
And I think the same thing has gone on in the aid business, that it's been a way of feeling out what works and what doesn't. And I think what it's shown is that free market and free trade policies are those that work best to promote development.
We have a
and
lot
that's
of,
the best hope for the 85% of humanity that live in poor nations. We can't give up on them.
We have a lot of listeners who would like to join this conversation, Bill. The number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Roman, you're on the line.
Oh, thank you very much. I'd like to speak to all the to the speakers today. Basically, I'm director of a humanitarian medical aid mission in Ukraine, and I've been doing this for 11 years. And I can honestly say that we are a PVO, a private volunteer organization, and all our volunteers do this work for nothing, including the doctors that go there, pay their own way, the medical technicians, nurses, etc. And I have to admit that on budgets of $15,000 to $25,000 a year, we have over 11 years provided $14 million of supplies, 500 tons. We have 11 ongoing projects, many of them first in Ukraine. And we have had 65 American specialists go to Ukraine specifically to teach, collegially, to teach these people, these doctors, nurses, and medical people, how to improve their medical systems. And what I have seen in 11 years, having worked initially with some major government institutions like USAID, like Fund for Democracy and Development, that PVOs do a better job because we are directed toward the target population. We don't have middlemen. All our volunteers are dedicated. We have the most effective use of funds and supplies, and we have excellent oversight. And I think the oversight aspect of these large groups is the worst part of how aid is given from...
Roman, is it not easier for you to be able to achieve that sort of success because you're doing something so that is so tightly focused, which is essentially making people healthier, as well as, I understand you're saying, training some of the doctors in a small program? Does that not make it a lot easier for you to achieve this sort of success?
Well, the fact is that what we've done is, when you say easier, you make it sound like it's easier to take people, have them volunteer, do things for nothing, than it is to pay someone huge salaries so that they can organize foreign aid.
Uh-huh.
To me, that's kind of backwards. What I'm saying is that it doesn't matter whether it's medicine, doesn't matter whether it's agriculture. I go to the villages in Ukraine all the time over mm-hmm. the period of 11 years, mm-hmm. and I can tell you I have not seen one new tractor given by USAID or any other large aid organization in these villages.
Bill Easterly, what about the point Roman is making, which is essentially about oversight and I think also a sense of distance from being at the at ground zero of where the aid is needed?
Well, I think these grassroots organizations are great, and they play a great role in economic development. We still don't know enough about their efficacy. We need more evaluation also of their efforts, just the same as we need evaluation of World Bank and IMF efforts. But I think there's a role for all these players in foreign aid. The grassroots organizations work well on a small scale, but it seems hard to translate their efforts into larger scale assistance.
Roman, thank you for your contribution to the conversation. Justin is calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Justin?
Hello?
Hello, Justin.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I wanted to ask a question that I haven't really heard brought up so far. It was on what's the role of structural adjust programs and debt relief and trade liberalization in foreign aid, and how they may or may not help or not help with the situation.
Bill Easterly?
Excuse me. I just wanted a comment on how, like, structural adjustment programs...
Yeah. No, we understood the question.
Yeah.
I just
want
to give Bill Easterly a chance to respond.
Structural adjustment programs are when the IMF and World Bank and other donors put conditions for policy reforms on their loans.
It's a loan with strings attached, essentially.
If the countries fulfill these conditions, then they get the money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the idea of these programs is good, that, and a lot of the reforms that are recommended, including trade liberalization and free market policies in general, are those that have proven over time to be the most successful at promoting economic development. The problem is the political incentives that Bruce has alluded to earlier, that the government really treats aid loans as a fairly minor incentive in the whole spectrum of how it decides how to allocate money. It has a much stronger incentive, in not all, but in many developing countries, to reward its political supporters with patronage. For example, to send political appointees to teachers, as teachers to schools, even if it fulfills the conditions to spend more on education.
Justin, okay. I hear you trying to come back in.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask, like, exactly how, say, like, with a structural adjustment program, how rerouting money from the public sector towards paying off debt would exactly encourage economic growth?
Well, the question of debt forgiveness is a tricky one, because if you just
because I would figure you would have to have some kind of infrastructure, like health and education, in order for it to be economic growth.
Right, absolutely.
Justin, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
If you just announce that you're forgiving all debt, then you create a perverse incentive to incur new debts.
What does that do, Bill? Isn't there a possibility of addiction to the loan?
Do you mean addiction
sorry,
if you
Bruce.
Don't
I,
forgive or if you
Bruce.
Do forgive?
I was actually addressing Bruce.
Well, I'll just pick up right where Bill was. Sure. Debt relief then says, well, who's going to lend to people if you're not going to get paid back? That's the issue.
This is Ray from San Francisco. I think there's a moral issue on this debt question that's being kind of overlooked, ignored, or sort of plowed under in the way we're dealing with it. The reality was a lot of these debts were incurred by irresponsible lending officers of the World Bank. They were incurred and given to authoritarian governments, and now we have democratic governments, and the populations of those governments are being made to pay the price of the authoritarian rule of yesteryear and the irresponsible lending of the major international institutions. And the policies that have accompanied structural adjustment, I think this is what the caller was calling in about, was trying to get at, was really the net effect of that was to put governments in a situation where they were effectively eliminating social sector spending for health and education or human development or pro-poor development, if you will, to repay loans. And we were saddling effectively democratic governments with this accusation that, you know, we would create a moral hazard by eliminating the debt problem, when, in fact, we weren't really analyzing the current context and creating positive incentives, which I think is Bill's argument, for maybe more pro-poor and more human development-centered practice.
Well, Ray, the World Bank and IMF have a program that partially forgives debt, when, in fact, there is evidence that a new reformist government that has the best interests of the population at heart is in power and is charting a new course.
The number
and
to call here.
It's very important to make it conditional on that.
Bill, I'm apologizing for interrupting, only because we do want to bring some callers into the conversation.
Okay.
We have some waiting. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Hello, Mohammed.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to make a comment regarding the latest comment made by a senator of Kentucky regarding the aid to Egypt and how he said we have to start reevaluating the aid and what we've gotten in return. That's in regarding to a comment made earlier by one of the speakers about the final beneficiaries of aid being the populations and the people mm-hmm. of the recipient nations, when in fact we should stop deluding ourselves, I think.
Well, what are you saying is the reality in Egypt with aid?
I think the reality is that they are bribes to keep the local dictator in charge and to reward him for, you know, keeping the only view that the U.S. would be pleased with and not the view that the people would be pleased with.
I think that's what Bruce Scott has been saying as well. Bruce?
Yes. Perfectly fair. But it's very hard to do something different because you're then talking about a political challenge to the existing regime.
Mohammed, I recall, again, I used to work in Egypt, and there were all of those buses around town that had the handshake, the logo of the handshake surrounded by an American flag.
Yes.
And those buses were, for some reason, looked on disparagingly by the Egyptians as gifts from the Americans. Is that a reflection of the cynicism that you're talking about?
Well, yes, it's I think everybody in Egypt realizes that they are part of the bribe, basically, like the regular blackmail, so that we can keep in line with the American policy. And it's got nothing to do with what the locals local policy is in terms of civil society or, you know, democracy.
And what was the bribe for, Mohammed? What was the bribe supposed to buy?
Well, basically, the more pro-Western policies for Egypt. And mainly, specifically regarding the peace process and how, you know, Egypt was supposed to stay in line and honor it, I think.
Well,
most of them started in 1979, I think.
Mohammed, thank you for your call. Wouldn't, Bruce Scott, a lot of American voters feel that if they're giving money to country X, they want country X to behave in a certain way for the money?
Oh, I think that's hard to say. I think when you pick Egypt or Jordan, you're picking something that's got a very specific political context, though very hard to discuss in this country, and where our notion of what needs to be done over there has very little support in the rest of the world, and we're powerful enough to do it and back it with that financial aid. That gets closer to what Bill was talking about earlier with the Cold War context. You've got some political objectives that don't have much connection with the Egyptian part.
The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. The question, Connection listeners, is it that we haven't been giving enough aid, or that we've been giving it to the wrong folks, governments, instead of grassroots groups? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection, and we're talking about foreign aid, politics and economics, corrupt governments, and some stingy ones. Connection listeners, what do we owe the world's poor, and how much are you willing to pay to move countries from poverty to prosperity? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are Bruce Scott, Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School, Bill Easterly, Senior Advisor with the World Bank and author of The Elusive Quest for Growth, and Ray Offenheiser, President of Oxfam America. Ray, we've been talking about the failures. You've had some successes here and there. Without going into a great deal of detail, I don't want you to present a list. Just give a sense of what works when it works, and what makes it work when it works.
Well, I think we've been doing a lot of rethinking of our basic approach to foreign aid, and I think one of the things we've realized is that a lot of the way foreign aid has been carried out has been very much informed by a welfare framework. In other words, the notion was we're giving money to governments where, in effect, we're, in some sense, gap-filling and providing public goods to citizens that perhaps their governments are not providing. And it's really we've realized that, in fact, the amount of money's available to our own agency and to the overall system of foreign aid globally, when applied through that kind of a welfare framework, will never really meet the needs of citizens in the developing world, and won't get the kinds of changes that will eliminate poverty and eliminate the kind of suffering that we're talking about. This has caused us, in effect, to look at this whole issue much more through a human rights lens and to focus much more on social and economic rights as a point of departure for how foreign aid should be viewed. It's caused us to see poverty much more in terms of social exclusion. Groups that are, in fact, not getting the kind of aid that...
Isn't all of this essentially political again?
Well, yes. I mean, I think in some sense it goes back to the fact that there are structures in place in many countries around the world that have favored certain groups over other groups, produced states that have not, in effect, been responsive to their citizenry and so on and so forth. And I guess where we're coming out is that we think that there really needs to be a radical rethink of the whole structure of foreign aid and perhaps the emergence of a new vision that is more in tune with the historical period we're living in. I mean, this is the post-Cold War era. It's the era of the information revolution. And most importantly, the development paradigm for today is really globalization. And the question I think we're grappling with is how do you do foreign aid in the era of globalization in a way that's inclusive and stresses equity and justice and benefits for not just a discrete group, but for a broad citizenry. And we think that's in the best interest of the United States government as well as private sector interests.
But to the many questions you're raising there, are you coming up with concrete answers yet?
Well, I think what we're finding today is we have to look at particular kinds of problems. For example, take the debt case. We believe, for example, that debt relief is the whole answer to the development problem, but we do believe that enabling governments. I think there's been 22 governments so far that have qualified for debt relief reinstate social sector spending for schools, health programs, environmental programs, for building farm-to-market roads is revitalizing the potential for human development in certain countries.
Right.
But what that's led us to is recognizing that we've got to work not just in countries to promote the proper use of those funds. In other words, I think a good example is Uganda, where debt relief was received. A civil society monitoring framework was put in place with lots of NGOs participating in oversight of how the government was distributing those debt relief funds for education and health.
Ray, I actually think you've made your point quite clearly, and I do want to get to some callers. The number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Sue, Cape Cod, hello.
Hello. I just wanted to give a couple of examples of success in the tightly focused way that Ramon talked about. That citizen partnership that Bill Easterly talked about is on both sides. In other words, if Americans believe that 15% goes to foreign aid and it's really 0.8%, we have an education problem. And if individuals like in Beerhorst Partners in Guatemala, having people in America and people in Guatemala have now clean water, better health care, better education in a very small way, admittedly. TechnoServe and Oxfam and Heifer Project, women's cooperatives with getting banking. They're very small ways in which small numbers of individuals can get help. And I think in all our neighborhood work in America and other places, we learn that it's one-on-one or one group with one group that makes change. And this is where I'd like to put our focus. In particular, I'd like to spend money back again on international family planning. And I'd love it.
Well, I'd like to bring up to Bill Easterly the question of family planning, because in your book, The Elusive Quest for Growth, Bill, you take on several of, I would say, traditional approaches to aid. You include education, debt relief, and family planning. In what way do you think, as you put it, distributing condoms is just no way to spend money? Why not? Explain that to our audience.
Well,
and I realize that the caller was not simply talking about distributing condoms, but you're not simply talking about that as well. You're using it more metaphorically.
All the evidence that has accumulated over the last 40 years is that there's no difference in economic growth performance between countries that slow down population growth and countries that do not slow down population growth. So there's no evidence that population growth has the disastrous effects on economic development that a lot of the family planning advocates say. And that's the historical record.
Sue,
and you can kind of think why that is, because you really you really only get development when people have an incentive to invest in the future. And when they feel that incentive, then they will invest more in each child and have less children on their own. They will have their own desire to have less children. It doesn't help to have some outside agency coming in handing out condoms and telling them to have less children. They have to have the desire on their own to reduce their families.
Sue, thank you for that call.
Yeah, but that's part putting the thing backwards, Bill, because they can have the desire if they don't have the access and they don't have the funds to pay for it and they don't have the education.
Condoms cost 33 cents. So
yeah,
that's a lot cheaper than the cost of a child.
Yeah, but that's only if you recognize it, and it's only if you have an education that you recognize it, right?
Let's go to our callers. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. 1-800-423-TALK. Dave, you're on the line.
Well, along the lines of the last comment, perhaps there isn't a correlation between population growth and economic development, but it seems to me that that it's not the issue of what male birth control, it's the issue of the empowerment of females that seems to have some correlation, and I'd like your callers to speak to that. I just think of the examples of, say, the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, which has turned women who were traditionally second-class citizens into entrepreneurs, and that seems to be a successful model.
Well, Bill Easterly, you actually challenged this notion that there's a connection between education and growth.
Yeah, that also is an idea that hasn't worked out well in the historical record. Africa actually increased education more than East Asia did. And, of course, East Asia grew much faster than Africa over the last few decades. And, again, the problem is that just throwing objects into poor nations doesn't work. Just building the schools and appointing the political appointees as teachers and forcing the kids to go to school, that doesn't work by itself. You really have to have the kids and their parents and the teachers all feel the incentive to make sure that skills are acquired, and that only happens when people have confidence that their efforts to invest in their own future will pay off and not be expropriated by the government or screwed up by the government, by government mismanagement of the economy.
Ray Oppenheiser of Oxfam, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, well, I hope that's not an argument for defunding education that Bill was just making.
No,
I mean,
no.
I guess our feeling was that that education
quality,
is essential.
Not quantity.
Yeah, well, I would fundamentally agree with that. I mean, I think fundamentally what we would agree on with Bill is that you've got to create an environment in which citizens have confidence that their government is delivering a quality educational product, number one. And how do you build, how do we think about the role of the state and strengthening the state and making some strategic investments through foreign aid and building a responsible state at the same time we're enabling participation at the grassroots? I think that's the kind of the synergy and tension we're looking for. I guess we feel, looking at it from a grassroots level, that it's education is extremely important in building human capital to participate in whatever form of development one is imagining, and that what worries us particularly about Africa today is actually the defunding of education because of the debt problem is leaving some generations of young people without any education, and I think it's going to make it, if we don't get education funding back on track, is going to leave several generations really out of the global process.
Bruce Scott.
Ray, I'd go back and just pick up your comment that everywhere, if you look at this, there's a fundamental importance to an effective state. That doesn't mean it's been a democratic state. If I just pick some of the ones, I'll pick the one in Africa that's been the big surprise is Uganda. Hey, it's not a democratic government in Uganda. It wasn't a democratic government in Korea. It wasn't a democratic government in Taiwan. It wasn't a democratic government in Chile. It isn't a democratic government in Singapore. And it isn't a democratic government in China. The big successes have come from people who had very strong states to straighten things out and get them marching. Most of them did it because they had a perceived enemy. Korea had an obvious enemy. Taiwan had an obvious enemy. I don't know about what one would say for either Chile or Uganda. Singapore has a very obvious set of enemies. There was a perceived threat that forced people to say, we've got to get our act together and try to do this. It's very hard to impose.
It seems to me we've spent a lot of time in this hour basically successfully making the case that what has happened in the past hasn't worked very well and has to change, and have not really yet heard very, very concrete ideas for a large-scale new approach. The need for a new approach, yes, but a new approach nobody seems to know. Bill Easterly, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what we the kind of approach we need is where countries come forward on their own, present their own reform programs to international aid donors and the development agencies like the World Bank and the IMF. And then the foreign aid community selects the best programs that the countries put forward, the best defined according to orientation towards free market, towards citizen participation, like Ray was talking about, towards preservation of property rights and other good institutions, like Bruce was talking about. And the aid community funds those homegrown programs, and it doesn't fund the governments that are unwilling to move in a reform direction.
It still sounds to me, Bill, as though you're raising a panoply of problems in the nature of the solution. It's not simple, is it?
It's not simple. What we have to do is just keep trying, experiment, evaluate what happened with each experiment, and continue the experiments that worked.
Bruce Scott, the same question to you. Where do we go for a solution?
Well, I'll just take where Bill was. Most governments have very little incentive to try to do things better. They can continue to rule no matter how badly they rule their country.
I hear you saying that, but okay. Where's the solution then?
I'd say for some of them, offer them the opportunity to create an effective system in a little tiny piece of their territory. All right, and in effect say you got to give up sovereignty in a small piece of your territory.
How likely is that?
Well, there are a number of them that have already done it. Okay, the government of Singapore is managing an area of Indonesia where they've got about 100,000 people working in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. You get there by landing at the Singapore airport, taking a Singapore boat, and you're in a Singapore set of administrative facilities there.
Ray Offenheiser, you have the last word on this. Your solution going forward.
I think fundamentally,
and it has to be brief. And I'd like you to leave out a list of problems as we've been hearing before.
Okay.
What's the constructive idea?
I think we need to look at this whole issue from more of a human rights perspective and go back to the Human Rights Charter of 1948, and look at both the civil, political, as well as social and economic rights, and begin to think more about the incentive structure, as Bill has been talking about, and how we can link up the market and the private sector more creatively to the development process. Foreign aid is an increasingly smaller part of what what will really sort of drive development in the future, and focus more on people, human development, and pro-poor strategies.
All right. Seems still we've left many more questions than answers to this, but it is a tough situation. I want to thank our guest this hour. Bruce Scott is professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Bill Easterly, senior advisor at the World Bank and author of The Elusive Quest for Growth. Ray Offenheiser is president of Oxfam America. Connection listeners, you can continue the foreign aid conversation at our online forum at theconnection.org. I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection.